Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roering, Mike Malott, Jack Spencer, and our special guest this week is Steve Liddle from the Dykema Law Firm. Thanks for coming over, Steve.
Great to be with you, Kyle.
What do you think of MERS World Headquarters? That's pretty exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great building.
It's everything that you thought it would be, I'm sure.
Absolutely. The compound is impressive.
You got past all the security and everything. You know, we do have security out here. We have some of the best security you're ever going to find around a building down here.
Almost as extensive as in the state capitol itself?
Yeah, almost. Very close, except we don't have the armed guard.
Such a high bar.
We're going to have a few things on the agenda today. The first thing I wanted to get your impression on is Mike Shirkey's editorial that he wrote for the Detroit News over the weekend, digging in and saying that it was the governor's fault that all these various items in the budget were vetoed. But I wanted to get some impressions on what you thought, everyone thought about it. We're going to start with you, John.
I thought it was interesting. It didn't quite sound like him. I was surprised by the absence of his reference to my governor. I do think it sort of displays exactly where we are with this process, and everybody's stomped their foot one more time, and I'm curious how close we get into December or how far we get in December without a resolution when things start hitting the road, so to speak.
Mike, what were you struck by?
Well, I think in continuation of the situation, the governor backed herself into a corner and Shirkey intends to let her twist in the wind.
Jack?
The fact that he felt, or their PR people felt it was necessary to do something like that is probably the most important aspect. He made the argument the way that you and I would if we were hired to make their side of the argument.
Doesn't sound like he's very close to trying to find some kind of middle ground or deal, does it?
I don't think that's what he's doing right now. I think what he's doing right now is he's trying to position the governor to when they start sending stuff to where it's going to be very hard to monkey around with it. And I think he wants to be able to send her as much of the stuff they want to send her and have the best chance of her feeling like she's just basically got to go along with it.
Steve, what did you think?
Yeah, I guess my perspective first would be, you know, as a lawyer and someone who, you know, spend some time working with the state constitution, that it isn't just incumbent upon either the governor, the Senate majority leader as one of the legislative chambers, or the legislature even as a body to determine these things, you know, for the benefit of the residents of Michigan. The constitutional process is you have not provided funding to anyone until it's enacted. And so the legislature can propose funding, but they haven't provided funding to anyone until they either can convince the governor that it's worthy of the governor's signature, or if they can't succeed in that route, gather enough votes in the legislature to override the governor's veto. That's a legal and constitutional process. Secondly, I think as a citizen, you know, and someone that represents occasionally clients who are interested in the outcomes of state government, you know, it's disappointing after seeing, you know, what appeared to be a bipartisan agreement within the last week or 10 days to sort of find a way to move forward in a legally binding way that would work for the administration and the legislature before everyone took off on a break to move the ball forward and have a real impact for Michigan residents.
Is it fair to say then that Shirkey he can't say that the Senate passed it. He can only say we got it this far. He's not done, though, until he reaches an agreement with the governor, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, it's no different than, for example, saying, well, we provided for this group because, for example, on a bill appropriating money made it out of a committee. There's no difference until it's enacted. Until the appropriation is enacted, there's no funding. That's the constitutional process. We don't have a parliament in Michigan where the legislative body acts, and that's the final say. The Constitution in Michigan sets up an executive budget process. The Republicans who controlled the Michigan Constitution Convention between 1961 and 1962 were very deliberate in wanting to empower the governor and provide a significant role for the governor in the appropriations process. They didn't view it as a legislative process.
He didn't refer to her as my governor, but he did use her last name many, many times in that.
Yeah, often in sentence after sentence after sentence. It was like Whitmer cut. We pass Whitmer cut. And again, I think it's part of the messaging and get her to sway in the breezes of this thing and then take the full responsibility of it and the full brunt of the political backlash of it. He wants everybody to know that, you know, these rural school districts, you're not getting your funding because Whitmer cut it. Your rural health care clinics, you're not getting your funding because she cut it. Autism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right now, we're still in the blame game. And I think until we actually get really, really close to seeing some schools up north either have to close or kids having to start being bused in the dead of winter for 2 hours, I don't think there's going to be enough political pressure to sort of bust up this logjam.
Steve, I want to ask you a question about rescinding vetoes. What's wrong with the idea of Governor Whitmer just rescinding some of her vetoes?
Well, the only thing wrong about it is that it's not permitted under the Michigan Constitution.
Oh, I guess that would be a problem.
So to restore vetoed money, yeah, it is a problem, isn't it? To restore vetoed money, that requires the enactment of a new law. And so that's a process that starts in the legislature. So the legislature has two constitutional options: muster sufficient votes within both legislative chambers, a two-thirds vote in each chamber to override the veto, which automatically restores the funding, or pass a new bill in a form acceptable to the governor and secure her agreement and signature.
Is there anything stopping the governor from rescinding her administrative board orders? How about that? Let's go there.
I think the administrative board is free as a body at any time to transfer within a department appropriated funds. And so if for some reason the governor said, hey, it makes some sense to make further adjustments and the legislature is not cooperating with me on this budget process during this fiscal year, she would have the opportunity to recommend, and given that it's composed of like-minded, generally like elected officials and her appointees, I think you're typically going to see the ad board follow suit on her recommendations.
I continue to make the point, the majority leader, about individual items or smaller supplementals. If you look at these different things, like autism and so on, there's nothing that prevented them from sending her just the supplemental to pay for that. And it would be clear and obvious if she vetoed it or did anything with it other than just sign it, that, you know, she'd clearly get the blame. It's obvious that's not what the legislature wants to do. They're looking ahead to their, in my opinion, to their bargaining position when they finally do start sending her things.
It kind of goes to what our last guest from the prior edition said, Dennis Muchmore, was the thing about supplementals or the thing about budgets is that you can always reach an agreement at any time. And once you decide that you want to pass a budget, basically what he said is you can pass a budget. There's no restrictions on the time or whatever. You can do it at any time. You just need the will to do it.
Right. I think we have seen both chambers of the legislature and the governor demonstrate a way in which they can act together on something like this already earlier this year. It's a bit obscure, but folks may remember that there was a bill relating to wrongfully convicted individuals that also included an appropriation funding payments to those folks. And the governor, citing a campaign commitment, vetoed that item of appropriation to fund that because it was connected to a substantive bill. It was her position on referending proof.
It was $10 million, wasn't it?
Right. And it was not likely to be subject to a referendum, but she had been very clear throughout the campaign and even in her first few days as governor, she wasn't interested in having those sort of bills signed. So what was the result? Did the parties go back and have a standoff and nothing move forward? No, they got back to the table and they worked out that a supplemental bill would be sent to the governor in a form that was acceptable to her. She signed it. What was the net result? The change in the law that everyone supported was made, and the appropriation of money that everyone supported was made. It just was done in a different form than the legislature originally proposed it.
I want to move on to a different subject now. We're recording, obviously, on Monday for MERS Monday, and a press conference took place in Southeast Michigan to announce the newest effort to establish some type of coordinated regional transit system in Southeast Michigan. According to the press release that we received, the idea is to create a foundation for Oakland, Wayne, and Washtenaw County to create a three-county regional transit plan. John, what's missing from this?
Brooks Patterson.
And?
Macomb County.
That seemed to be kind of glaring, doesn't it? It's like a big beacon. What about Macomb County? It's only like a million people.
You've removed one of the two big obstacles that has faced regional transit for a long, long time, and with the passing of the Oakland County executive and by taking Macomb out of the mix. I mean, I don't know why you wouldn't have thought of that earlier as far as geographically making it easier to pass.
Doesn't this defeat the whole idea of regional transit if you just take an entire county, which represents a huge, significant part of the region, just out of the equation, Mike?
Well, it would seem to, but I think the issue with transit in Southeast Michigan has been getting political buy-in from all of the various parts, and if they have to leave one part out to make that happen, maybe that's where they feel they need to go.
If their arguments are right and this succeeds and it really stimulates the economy down there and takes down some barriers to transportation needs, Macomb could easily, in 5 years from now, say, hey, we want in.
Yeah, that's very possible. Jack, you had mentioned something here about the leadership of Wayne, Washtenaw, and Oakland County that I thought was interesting.
Well, they're all Democratic at the moment, Democrat-controlled, and Macomb County is whatever Macomb County happens to be, which is always sort of let's just say they're not a clear red or blue county for the most part.
They're not progressive, that's for sure.
Well, they're simply not necessarily known for sitting back and agreeing to a lot of things. But I doubt very much if this works and you have Washtenaw in there instead of Macomb and they finally get some kind of transit, I don't think people are going to be looking back and say, gee, I really wish we were in the good old days of Darda. If they got any kind of agreement at all after all these years, I suspect they should jump on it.
Now, Steve, you've got a background in doing regional transit stuff. Tell our listeners about your experience on this issue.
Sure. I actually was involved back in 2003 helping the original DARTA agreement.
Oh, the DARTA thing. Yeah. I found an old squishy DARTA bus the other day.
Yeah, those were all over Mackinac Island at the Mackinac Island Conference in 2003. Yes, you have all those. I think Mayor Kilpatrick managed to swipe all of the signing pens from the signing of the agreement on that day as well. So
I'm sure he can use them right now where
perhaps.
He is at.
You can do letter writing when you're incarcerated. So,
are they worth more now or less now than they were back then?
Yeah, if you were to put those pens on eBay, how much could you get for them?
Yeah, I'm not sure how much the Governor Granholm signing pens are going for on eBay. I didn't have much luck with my Governor Blanchard pens when I posted them once either. So
on this new agreement here, what they're trying to do here, what strikes you here? What do you think needs to happen in order for this to be successful?
I think one thing that's important to remember with Macomb County does participate already in regional transit through SMART. It actually does so at a greater degree than actually all of the other counties, because Macomb County levies their SMART tax countywide. Both in Oakland and Wayne County, there are opt-outs, and Washtenaw doesn't participate in regional transit through SMART, and there is no countywide regional transit. So I view this effort amongst the three counties to sort of supplement existing regional transit. I know there are other priorities that Macomb County has that they're going to have to visit with their voters about in 2020 in the forms of needs for the county jail and a countywide educational initiative through the ISD that folks in Macomb are interested in supporting. So it may just be a timing issue from the perspective of Macomb. And as John Rearick suggested, there is authority, the way this is structured, if they choose to join later, that certainly probably would be an option given the structure the parties are using. So it looks to be an effort where there's consensus amongst the residents generally and the leaders based on the 2016 election and the current leadership to proceed. And they can do that in a way that integrates with the existing systems and just enhances them in a way that moves the ball forward.
As far as this works from a technical standpoint, do you need the legislature to pass something so that the three counties can then pass something, or do you even need the legislature?
I think if folks were paying attention to bills that were introduced last week when the legislature was in, there's House Bill 5229, which amends the Municipal Partnership Act, which is a law that was passed in 2011 or 12 and allows local governments like counties and cities and public authorities to enter into an agreement and levy a tax to support their activities. But that tax would be subject to tax capture. So much like the Detroit Institute of Arts and Zoo Millage that was subject to capture initially, House Bill 5229 would eliminate that tax capture and make it clear in terms of which voter approval is necessary. So I'd be paying attention for observers interested in regional transit to see what happens to House Bill 5229.
Is that the Jason Shepherd bill?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, okay. He happened to be at this press conference. So he might know something about that. Very good catch. Something else we wanted to talk to you about. Now, some of our listeners may remember you as the legal counsel for Jennifer Granholm. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what the chief legal counsel does for a governor?
Sure. There's actually a pretty broad range of responsibilities. I remember when I was initially starting as a deputy legal counsel to Governor Granholm. Kelly Keenan was her initial legal counsel. He's now the Deputy Attorney General, working for Attorney General Nessel. He had come back from a meeting with Lucille Taylor, who had been Governor Engler's general counsel. And she described working in that office as practicing law at 100 miles an hour. And I don't disagree with that. And then secondly, you know, I think at another event, you know, I heard Lucille indicate that you had to get used to seeing, you know, your judgments, you know, questioned basically, you know, on the front page of the papers at the time. You know, now it may be Twitter or other social media, you know, and podcasts even, right? Yeah. So that's not something that, you know, most attorneys are used to at all. They're used to sort of, you know, criticism in a brief back and forth. But to see it sort of publicly, that's something that you have to get used to.
So you need thick skin is what you're saying.
I don't know that it's thick skinned. You know, lawyers tend to be a little passive aggressive. So you have to find, you know, sort of an effective outlet for how you're going to manage that criticism. Right? In the end, it ended up being, hey, let's just go do some exercise. For me, it was the best way to deal with that. And, you know, if it was frustrating, go find a way to deliver a win for the governor as opposed to being frustrated.
Now, how much relationship does the chief legal counsel for the governor have with the attorney general's office? Or is it determined by the players involved?
That's going to depend, you know, on the relationship between the governor and the attorney general. So it's been contentious, you know, under the current constitution. You know, there was a very contentious relationship initially between Attorney General Kelly and Governor Romney. There's actually a document out there that documents how they agreed to proceed forward. I think Richard McClellan used to refer to it as the Treaty of Lansing. And that has sort of set the groundwork generally for the relationship between attorney generals and governors, you know, since the time. And
so is the attorney general the governor's lawyer?
Yes. The attorney general is the lawyer to the governor. She is the responsible for representing all state officials. You know, technically, she is the lawyer for the legislature as well under the laws of the state.
So why do you need a chief legal counsel if you got the lawyer being the attorney general?
I think that the case law of the state recognizes that, you know, technically the governor is the chief executive officer, and there may be instances where her lawyer at the Department of Attorney General may disagree. There's also just significant legal responsibilities vested exclusively in the governor. You know, they can be even obscure. You know, for example, under the Urban Cooperation Act, it's only the governor that makes a determination as to whether or not that agreement complies with the law or not. But under municipal charter provisions, it's a joint determination. If a municipality wants to submit a charter amendment, it goes both to the AG and to the governor for a review. There are instances where they disagree, you know, and so I think by all indications I have seen, there's generally a pretty good working relationship between the current governor and the current attorney general and their staffs. Obviously, that was not the case between Attorney General Granholm and Attorney General Cox. Most of the interaction, you know, in terms of formal interaction between the offices were demands from the governor for the attorney general to do his job, which was, you know, not different from the relationship between Governor Engler and Attorney General Granholm, where literally there were malpractice charges filed against the governor, questioning her ability to do her job as attorney general by Governor Engler's team.
Talk about the role that the counsel to the governor would play in terms of legislation. Is there that much of a role? I mean, how did you interface with a lobbying team?
I and others in the governor's counsel office, you know, interfaced quite closely with the governor's legislative team. I had the benefit of experience working in a couple legislatures, both in Michigan and Illinois, before Kelly Keenan had been on legislative staff long before going to law school, for example. And so there's basically two areas. One, and this has been the practice generally for most administrations, anything of legal effect, where the governor may take some action that's of legal effect, it's always wise to have someone from the legal counsel's office review. So for the legal counsel's office, in addition to analyses done by every lead agency and anything prepared by the legislative staff, there'll be a legal review of every bill that the governor... Every bill.
How big is your team?
Where's the team, though?
The team would range from anywhere between 4 to 7 lawyers, if you count some part-time lawyers.
I had no idea it was that big.
It was a little bigger in the Granholm administration because there were some new functions and activities that we had to take on. For example, the advice and consent process can be pretty time-consuming in terms of background checks and vetting. So we had one attorney essentially assigned almost full-time for that. With the expansion of tribal government relations, that's almost a full-time job. That's another attorney who may have some other responsibilities. So I think that, you know, that's a fairly typical size. And it's you break up that work. So I can remember a lot of Christmas vacations, you know, between Christmas and New Year's, where I'm sitting at my kitchen table as the kids are assembling Legos and I'm, you know, reviewing bills for any sort of legal issues. So that's something that's just sort of the final check. There are a number of issues where the governor's legal counsel actually may be the lead agency. You know, for example, anything election related, criminal justice issues. Well, you'll work with and defer, particularly in the current instance, to the AG and to the Secretary of State. They don't work for the governor. And so the governor's position may be different. And so you may be more engaged as the lead agency for the governor's office on those issues. And you're going to be working closely with legislative affairs. And then generally, you're there as a resource and sort of a second set of eyes and ears where you're looking for legislation that may have an impact on executive powers, other constitutional issues, and just sort of general policy issues where the legal folks may be involved.
So you're kind of disturbing my my preconceptions. You're telling me that if you put seven lawyers end to end, they will actually sometimes reach a conclusion?
I think that my experience, both under Kelly Keenan and mine, was, you know, we're going to defer to the attorneys in our office in terms of a review, but the ultimate lawyer's decision was the governor. You know, the governor was a lawyer when I was the legal counsel, and the governor is a lawyer now. And so it's just, you know, a recommendation. You know, we would raise issues, you know, want you to be aware. If the governor wanted to proceed with something, you know, we may or may not take action. You know, it could be, we'll let this one go, you know, deal with this one another day. Let's correct this later. Maybe we'll send a corrective message. Let's veto this and tell them what we will sign, et cetera.
So it could be 7-1, but if the one was the governor, the one would win.
Right. The governor always makes the final call.
So really then, take communications out and take the political operation out. The legal counsel is really kind of the boiler room for the exercising and utilizing the governor's powers.
I think that when you operate in an office whose powers are constrained by Constitution and the law, it's only wise to make sure you're operating within those boundaries. I think we have seen instances, you know, in the past where it appears as if the governor's team may not have been into the loop or may have been sort of the last to know, or warnings that they were raised were not necessarily heeded. It did always feel empowering as a lawyer to know that your client, the governor, always had your back and wanted to know your thoughts or your team's thoughts on anything that she may do. But there's a lot, you know, the entire appointments process. No appointment generally is made without a review by someone in the governor's team. Even press releases are reviewed to make sure that there's...
They run press releases through the legal shop?
Look, an effective governor's office is going to have a senior staff team where no one on the senior staff does not know what else is going on because there may be an unintended consequence. Mm. And so if the governor were to make some statement about, for example, what a bill did or what she was authorized to do, that's wrong. You know, sometimes the lawyers are the ones that are quickest to catch on those sort of details. So it's handy to have a team that operates together on all those things.
So you were the head of the Governor Whitmer Transition Team Legal Counsel. Am I getting the phrase right?
Yeah, I was general counsel to the Whitmer-Gilchrist transition for a couple months at the end of last year, yes.
What struck you about Governor Whitmer? In which ways was she similar to your former employer, Governor Granholm, and in which ways was she different?
They're obviously different. I've never made the mistake of confusing the two. That's been a fairly common thing, right? Both during the campaign and since then. I think that one key difference, obviously, is the governor's long tenure, current Governor Whitmer's long tenure in the legislature. And she, in addition to that, she's someone that's sort of been in and around Lansing, you know, for quite a while. You know, I first met her when we were brand new attorneys. I at Dykema, she at Dickinson, like in the late 90s. And she, you know, she was doing things like hearings at the Michigan Public Service Commission for clients, amongst other things, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Governor Granholm obviously spent time first out of state, then in Wayne County, never worked in the legislature. So that was clearly different in terms of how she wanted to approach some planning for the transition, the relationship with the outgoing administration and the legislature during the lame duck session. Governor Granholm was a pretty tough person. I think what sort of surprised me in getting to see Governor Whitmer do some of the same work during the, she may be even tougher.
Really? Right?
And if she is clear in terms of here's how I'm going to proceed, and she sent that message, I would not expect, you know, folks to sort of find a way to change that position until they've reached some accommodation or agreement with her.
How far does this go? You're making me very curious here. If the administration wants to put out a press release, and they run it by the attorneys, would the attorneys typically say, don't use that word, use this other word, things like that? Does it go to that level?
Typically, it would just be in the form of a suggestion. You know, for example, if I think back, one example may pop to mind during the Kilpatrick removal proceedings. Obviously, our communications team, Liz Boyd and others, would be putting out press statements or media releases. And, you know, we may sort of say, well, no, this element of the removal proceeding is actually, you know, prior to removal. So I would use this word. Here's a suggestion. And she would take all those suggestions, you know, amongst the senior team and prepare a final version for review of the governor.
As you're writing these reviews, who gets to see them and what happens to them when the decisions are made? Are they kept in a file cabinet or what happens to them?
They were just simply emails. You know, by even 2003, there wasn't a need to produce any more paper document or a memo. And they weren't comprehensive reviews of the bill. They would tend to be, you know, a brief statement as to what they did. And then we would highlight any, you know, legal or constitutional issues. Those would be circulated to the senior team, you know, in communications, external affairs, policy, legislative affairs, in advance of anything going to the governor's desk. So that the chief of staff and other senior leaders would know what was going to the governor's desk, and then they would be submitted to the governor, you know, with all of the other materials relating to the bill. You know, we'd either get, you know, a question sometimes from the governor ahead of time, sometimes, you know, when she was in her office or wherever she was going to be doing the signings, you know, you'd call in or have a call on occasion. But it was just a mechanism to make sure there was a second set of eyes and that, you know, the everyone on the team knew what was going on, and there weren't surprises.
Is there a particularly big save that pops into your mind going back to your tenure as, as legal counsel at Granholm? Like maybe like, well, nobody caught that and it was a big deal?
Sure. Around 2005 or so, County Executive Brooks Patterson wanted to change the law with regard to any replacement in the event the county executive decided to retire or passed away. And that's the optional unified county government statute. There's only two counties that operate under that, Oakland and Bay County. And at some point while that legislation was moving, Tom Hickner, who was the county executive up in Bay County at the time, had just been diagnosed with cancer. And inadvertently, the folks in Oakland County had written it in such a way so that it would apply to Oakland County. But they had also written it in such a way so that there was no mechanism to replace the Bay County executive in the event of a death. The Bay County executive. We were able to let the governor know about that, and he said, well, this is potentially an issue. You know, we didn't really hear about this from the folks in Oakland County. They just sort of ran to the legislature. You know, let's send it back and tell them how we think we should do it, right? You know, you can provide them language, right, to address that issue. Sure. And so it was a Senator Mike Bishop bill before he was majority leader. He wasn't happy about it, but it was vetoed. Shortly after that time, he started wearing a number 5 pin around on his lapel because 5 of his bills had been vetoed by the governor.
Is that why they didn't get along?
but he did agree to modify it, you know, consistent with the governor, and everything proceeded. And actually that law just, you know, went into effect. It was put in motion in Oakland County here. Just a couple months ago, and resulted in Dave Coulter's appointment. And actually, before that, Jerry Poisson's temporary operation as the deputy executive. So that's one. Another big one would be some legal problems with the tie bars on the 21st Century Jobs Fund, where a review of those bills as they came in demonstrated that the Republicans' attempt to tie bar the 21st Century Jobs Fund to tax cuts the governor didn't agree to were legally problematic. And so we were able to deal with those, sever some of the tax cuts, and the governor got the jobs thing she wanted that the Republicans had agreed to, but they didn't get the tax cuts that she had not agreed to.
Because they didn't do the tie bars right.
Correct.
Yeah, I seem to remember that now.
Yeah. So those are the sort of things that you catch in a legal review. It's definitely demonstrated, you know, there's definitely value to the citizens in making sure, you know, their lawmakers do things correctly. And, you know, to the governor in that office to making sure that, you know, her or his agenda gets advanced.
Lawyers save the day. Steve Liedl from the Dykema Law Firm, thanks for coming in today. We appreciate it.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts, Jack, Mike, and John. Any big news here? With the temperature in here is nice and toasty, unlike last week. And Mike, your house is nice and toasty again, I hope.
Yeah,
we got a thermos. We got a furnace working again.
I struggled late last week with the thermostat, but we finally got it under control, and I spent the weekend in toasty environs.
How confident are you that the heat will still be on when you go home?
About 85%.
Okay. You didn't have to build a fire in the living room or anything, did you?
So, unlike a certain number one ranked, unmentioned, unnamed lobbyist, it wasn't just the batteries?
I don't know what it was. We switched the batteries, so, but we also switched out the thermostat. Anyway, we got it solved, and I didn't have to cuddle up with my dog to stay warm.
That unnamed lobbyist.
That unnamed lobbyist who probably everybody knows.
If you're on Facebook. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Until next time, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.